Tonight, we're going to try to tie in science and spirituality, the power of prayer, the power of thought, malicious thought, intent, and tie it all together with our guest, Bill Sweet. We'll be back with Bill in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. Bill Sweet, always interested in paranormal phenomena and also prayer through meeting the founders of Spindrift, Bruce and John Klingbeil. Bill began to grasp new ways of applying consciousness research to religion, to science. He was the president of Spindrift for 4 years. He's put it all together in a remarkable journey into prayer book, Bill Sweet on Coast to Coast. Hi, Bill. How are you?
Oh, I'm fine. Great being with you, George.
Good. Likewise. Likewise. I've noticed throughout the book, there's many references to Spindrift. What is that?
Spindrift is the symbol for what our company is a nautical term. You'd be interested in this as a Navy person. It has to do with the spray at the top of a wave during a hurricane or a storm out at sea. It's a very dangerous blowing around mist on the top of a wave. That's called the spindrift. And it's between the visible liquid, and it blows so fast some of it goes to vapor. And it blows so fast that if you feel the spindrift in your skin, it's like little nails. And I've never seen it in person. And that picture on the cover of the book is Spindrift.
So how did you tie that in?
Because the Spindrift research is at the edge of consciousness between the visible and the invisible, between the material world and the spiritual psychic world. And we're right at that edge there, that cusp, that wave. And it's a very controversial and very turbulent area when you study the borderline of things and the boundaries of things. And that's how we tied in, because we're doing this consciousness parapsychology research and we're bringing in science and religion into the mix, and it becomes very combustible.
At any point prior to Spindrift doing this work, did anybody start to investigate science and spirituality and try to tie them together?
There have been sporadic tries to do it here and there. When this there's a guy named LaShawn who did it in New York, tried to find out if he could find patterns in the way different people prayed and find out if spirituality benefited people. And there have been other people from time to time. Most of the research that has been done with consciousness has come out of the parapsychological community, but most of the time with them, they have kind of a funny feeling of getting into spirituality and religion. Now, it's different today, but every once in a while they look at it. But nobody's looked at it more thoroughly and over a longer period of time than the Spindrift researchers. And there were, at the time, we were really active, starting from 1969 through the 90s. We had about 12 people, amateur scientists, but were interested in these spiritual and psychic issues, who were doing research and getting a lot of advice from other people doing research. And we brought in a lot of people and tested them. So in the long run, we've done it over a longer period of time than anybody else. But we're trying to bring parapsychology and parapsychology together and show that there is an incompleteness to studying consciousness unless we look at the high end of consciousness, the spiritual part. And we feel that we've been kind of successful in the evidence that we have provided other researchers of what our experiments have shown. We were kind of in the background, a grassroots group that nobody knew about here in Chicago and in Salem, Oregon. But we provided our amateur information to other institutions, and they picked up the work. And a lot of people who were more qualified and who had didn't have to worry about it, they had tenure and things, could look into things today that we seem to be mainline, like looking into prayer, spirituality, forgiveness research, and how this relates to healing and things. And so we're kind of happy how that turned out. And the reason I wrote my book, A Journey into Prayer, by Bill Sweet, is that nobody knew the Spindrift story except people in research and some relatives and some people who disapproved of what we were doing. They found out these Spindrifters were testing prayer and became very enraged. So besides that, nobody knew about it. So that's, I think, why there's interest in the book. It's a story that is unknown until now.
Well, what's important, too, is to create the distinction that prayer isn't necessarily being religious. It's totally different. Though people who are religious pray, you don't have to be religious to pray, right?
You are right, and this is one of the things that I think bothers people. There are some religions who want to have a monopoly on prayer, and they've told me to my face, and I've heard them talk on TV to other people, too, that you have to be of a certain belief system in order for God to hear your prayers. And, of course, Well, boy, that gets controversial. But what we found in our research that it had more to do with the quality and the of the consciousness of the individual and the spirituality of the individual than it did any particular denomination. That was kind of a surprise.
How did you, Bill, get involved in all this?
I had a lot of psychic and spiritual experiences as a young person. And strangely enough, when I was 15 in the North Shore of Chicago, I started thinking deeply about them. And what happened was, and I'd be interested, this is true for you too, the more I thought about them, the less I had them. In other words, as long as they were spontaneous and you weren't paying attention to them, that was fine. But as soon as you tried to analyze them, they started to disappear. Have you ever had any, does that make any sense to you?
Yes, sure does.
So then I said, well, gee, if I... It's kind of a conundrum. I'm interested in it, but if I show interest in it, then they go away. So I said, well, if there's any way to find any proof in the future, I want to get myself hooked up with people that are looking into consciousness and parapsychology and coming up with some subtle ways that we can actually test for the evidence of prayer and the evidence of some psychic things where we can end run this phenomenon, it seems, of is that when you think about something, you interfere with it. And so I was always interested in these things, and fortunately, through a social situation of all things, in the late 70s, a woman told me that I had to meet her brother and father in Schaumburg, Illinois, and they were doing tests of people with prayer, and so that was my first introduction to Bruce and John Klingbeil. And Bruce and John Klingbeil were professional Christian Science practitioners. By the way, practitioners are healers. And they were discovered ways to bring religion, science, and consciousness together by testing prayer. And they had this strong interest in spiritual science as well, and connecting it with natural science. Oh, by the way, a little trivia thing. Albert Einstein was interested in two religions. He was interested in the Quakers and Christian Science. Albert Einstein's interest in Christian Science was partly over this point of attaching science to religion. And this is exactly what Bruce and John Klingbeil work hard to do, the qualities of religion with the measurements of science. And they started an organization called Spindrift Research that would be a way for them to have the work in come out to the public. It was an organization to present the work. And what they did was is they had a laboratory set up in their living room, and people from different backgrounds came filing in and out to see how their prayers did in the scientific setting. It was a wild time, and it was a very exciting thing, too. And you can just imagine the controversy that started, people having their prayers tested. That doesn't seem so taboo today, but in the 1970s and 80s and into the first half of the 90s, that was a very strange subject, and it caused a lot of anger with some people, and other people, they loved it. So it just depended on how you looked at it.
And tell me, how did they test prayer, Bill?
Well, they used what was known at the time in basic parapsychology experiments, and they got some advice from scientific people on the scientific method to make sure they're doing everything right. That's where our money went. We got a lot of mathematical and scientific advice to make sure we're doing things right. Most of the tests that involved prayer involved the effect of prayer on random number generators on the effects of some psychokinesis experiments, but mostly it was plants. And the way we used plants instead of people was is that plants would be put under some kind of stress that was natural to them, like ultraviolet light or too little watering, or they were over-soaked, or there was something in the soil that was hindering their growth. And we would bring somebody in who was either experienced with prayer or just had the desire to pray for the experiment. And the plants would be hooked up to a computer that would be measuring different weight changes and different things going on in the plant.
All right. So this is pure science here.
This is basic science showing subtle effects of psychic effect between a healer and a healy. That's right. And they'd have a control group plant that wasn't affected. And certain people were able to get results and certain people weren't. But what was most interesting is that when you did science, as you know, you have to come up with, you have something to test. So what are you testing? Well, we're testing the effect of thought on some plant systems. Okay, well, what are you testing for? Well, we're trying to see if they can heal a plant from some kind of stress. So what is that healing? Well, healing is the restoration of order. Well, there's order. Now, there's something you can measure. Okay, well, what are you testing? Well, we're testing prayer. Well, what does that mean? Well, the Klingbeils had a lot of experience with prayer, and they postulated two different mental intentions that were tested in prayer. And one mental intention came from what people understand as petitionary prayer, where you ask for something. People always ask and they want things. Okay, well, that's petitionary prayer. The Klingbeils called that, for scientific purposes, goal-directed prayer. Petitionary prayer is when you expect a result, a specific result. Mm-hmm. It's goal-directed prayer. Then the second type of prayer is a more of a holier prayer. Is when you get out of yourself and your ego, and you don't pray for what you want, but you're praying for what you need and what you may not even know what you need. It's just an open prayer. And it's called non-goal-directed prayer. It's when you get the goals out of the way, and you expect the unexpected, and you're open to many things. You think outside the box, you're praying outside the box. This non-goal-directed prayer, we think, is more holy prayer because it ties in with thy will be done versus my will be done, or what I want is what you get from directed prayer, which often happens with goal-directed prayer is that you ask for things you want, but they're not necessarily what you need.
Now, this work, though, Bill, with plants.
Yes.
Why not use people?
We didn't see a way where we could afford to do that. It was too expensive and also too complicated. We wanted to have simple, basic experiments. We thought about animals, but plants were a simple way to go and something we could afford to do. And also, we could show more of this one-on-one relationship between the healer and the plant. Also, when you work with people, you have a lot of variables. You have especially the placebo effect. Some people are expecting to be healed, and so that enters into it, and then you have kind of a murky experiment. You don't know why the person's healed. So we were trying to get down into what people probably fear when they go to high school and college, is doing basic science experiments on consciousness and prayer, and keep it as simple as possible. So what we find is less variables to explain the data. It's more of a simple way to explain the data. And it worked pretty well. We were able to test people. Now, how that worked on goal-directed prayer and non-goal-directed prayer, you'd be very interested in that. And this is one of the things that leads up to when we're going to talk about how not just people using prayer in a negative way, but sometimes people in a well-meaning, benign way want to use prayer, but they end up actually hurting people, is that the plants had certain specific needs that we got information from botanists for when we knew what each plant
needed. All right, such as, what do they need?
Okay, well, let's take yeast as an example. That's one we can probably visualize over the radio.
Right.
Yeast chemists, there's chemists that do nothing but study yeast. It probably sounds like the most boring thing in the world, but these guys are very special.
Got a degree in yeast inspections, huh?
Yes, can you imagine? How do you like that one?
Yeah.
If you can imagine that during a 40-minute run of a test, yeast has different points every couple minutes where it needs to, like watching an EKG, where it has certain things happening to it. And it's giving off certain kinds of gas so it stays healthy and stays fresh and stays comfortable. If you add in a pot of yeast, if you add something to interfere with that normal reference of healthy yeast, so like overheat it or you feed it some kind of food that's dragging it down. You know how it is. Like if you try to exercise, you have to eat a meal, your digestive system stopping you from doing it because you're over dragged down.
Uh-huh.
The yeast is the same way. And you have somebody come in who's an experienced prayer or not, if it wants to see how they do it, they pray for the yeast to relieve its stress so it returns back to this normal state. And this is something you can see on a computer graph. But what's interesting is that the yeast chemist showed what the yeast needed at every couple-minute interval for it to happen. Now, the people that came in with goal-directed thought had an idea in their mind they were going to help the yeast. They had no idea what they were praying for, but they know the yeast needed help. They ended up pushing the yeast around psychically. They actually did have an effect on it, but they were pushing it in ways that weren't natural for it. So they actually ended up hurting it, in a sense, because it was being affected by thought, but it wasn't in congruence with what was healthy for it. Then you bring in somebody who is open and loving and is praying for what is best in the situation, someone who is praying that thy will be done, non-goal-directed prayer. They pray for the yeast, and it matches up and overlaps a graph of healthy yeast, and it returns to the state, and the norms and those intervals match up. So you get these two different patterns you can see from two different types of prayer. And then the third thing that happens, some people pray and they don't get results. But what we have found is that it's a lot easier to pray with a goal-directed prayer than non-goal-directed prayer, but yet non-goal-directed prayer is the more desirable prayer because prayer, we're always getting our ego in there and our ideas in there and our agendas in there.
Now, you said that prayer can be used for malicious intent. Is that the right terminology to use, prayer, to do that, or is that something else? I always thought prayer was good.
No, and that's a subject that a lot of people don't want to talk about. In fact, I got a lot of grief for writing as much as I did in my book about negative prayer. Some people told me I had to take some things out, which I took a few things out. But
was it that bad?
Well, it's easier to do harm with your thoughts and prayers than it is to do good. We have to be very careful.
Why?
Because when we pray, we have these psychic things in our mind of what we think should happen in a situation. And then again, if we're malicious to start out with, that's our true motive in prayer, and we're covering up with something else. I can think of an example from my own experience where I was praying consciously to and saying I forgave somebody, but underneath in my unconscious mind I was seething in unforgiveness. And it was the unforgiveness that was really going out there. I just know it. And we have to be real careful with our thoughts. And I think what on top of people not seeing prayer as can be a good or bad, it is a taboo. People have to start thinking about that. I think we're sort of forced to after 9/11. Prayer can be used for good or it can be used for evil. It's almost like Star Wars. The Force has a light side and it has a dark side.
Well, I'm sure there are some people who are praying for our downfall, for example. And, you know, we would consider it evil. They wouldn't.
Well, then we have to define what is evil and what is good. And I would say for our Spindrift experiments, and it's been very helpful to me, evil brings disorder and chaos, and good brings order and harmony. And so if they can't agree, if they think that evil and chaos is good, that's their highest concept of it. And some people do think like that. It's amazing. And also, some people are very confused today what is good and what is evil. It's a different kind of world than it used to be.
Doesn't evil intent, I'll say evil intent because I just can't say evil prayer, Bill. I don't know why, but I can't.
So you should see the translations of some of these prayers from the terrorists.
So can I get by saying evil intent? Is that accurate?
Well, you can do it if you want, sure.
All right.
You're more comfortable.
If someone is practicing evil intent on other people, won't it come back? Won't that negativity come back on that person 5-10 times as bad as what he's sending out?
That's what I hear, and I suppose in the ultimate of things, people get their recompense. But what I've noticed is there's a lot of hardy criminals and sinners out there that seem to get away with things for a long time. I mean, look at how long it took for Saddam Hussein, for instance. You would think of all the people, all the evil he did and all the things he was doing that would have come back on him, but it didn't. It just had to...
Well, I don't know. I'm not so sure about that. He is dead now.
Yeah, but that was from a physical action. It wasn't from anything he did came back to him as a mental force. I thought you meant when we send out evil, it comes back to us as evil.
Well, no, to me it could come back to you in any forms that would harm you. So it could be a heart attack. It could be stress that topples you. In his case, he got toppled. His evil eventually caught up with him.
Right, but a lot of good, then you have to explain why the good thing, bad things happen to good people, too, and that becomes...
Well, that's tricky. That I want to ask you about when we come back. Why do good things happen why do bad things happen to good people? Tell me about your website real quickly, Bill.
Well, it's spindriftresearch.org, and on there you can go to directly to Amazon.com, or you can go to axelievers.com, who's my publisher. And if somebody would rather get my book through a telephone number, the telephone number is 1-888-795-4274. That's 1-888-795-4274. That's the publisher. And what you can find out in my book, A Journey into Prayer, is about the research at Spindrift, the research some other people have done, the strange things that happen to us paranormally at Spindrift, and a lot of insights into prayer, too. And the people might be uncomfortable with some of the dark sides of prayer, but I think if we're going to study prayer, we have to study all of it.
Well, when we come back, we'll continue our dialogue with you, Bill, about the dark sides of prayer and also consciousness experiments. We've done them on Coast to Coast before. I want to get your take on whether you think we should continue those kinds of experiments. And I'll give you some highlights and examples when we come back. I'm George Norrie, our special guest tonight, Bill Sweet, on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie with our guest tonight, Bill Sweet. Bill, let's talk about some consciousness experiments that you did at Spindrift and what we have been doing here. They appear to work, changing direction of hurricanes, helping horses heal, though it wasn't successful in the end result, but it might have worked as it prolonged one's life. What's your take on that?
When I was listening to your commercial there about the Purina dog chow, I never heard that before. The dog's hearing is up there so they can hear rodents?
Yep, I never knew that either.
That is fascinating. You know, that actually relates to prayer because prayer relates to how folks pay attention, and that dogs pay attention to rodents, I guess. That's their prayer.
It could be.
It's a prayer is a way of paying attention. Prayer is a relationship resonating attention, and it's how we pay attention that determines the quality of how we can come across in these experiments or in life and things. And this attention thing is very interesting. You've probably heard about all these attention experiments, and of course, you've done the collective experiments of attention there on Coast to Coast. And the interesting thing about that is that they ended up scaring Art Bell.
Yes, Art was scared of it. He has slowly gotten back into some of this, I dive into it. What's your take? Is it worth trying and experimenting?
Oh, I'm an experimenter from the word go, yes. They always say that and those Frankenstein movies, the townsfolks get angry. They don't know what the guy, Dr. Frankenstein's doing up there, so let's go burn down the castle. I think we should look into all experiments and see where everything leads. I think that's going to happen anyway.
Are there consequences, though, to doing things like that?
Well, there's always consequences, but there's always, if you don't do them, somebody's going to outdo them anyway. So we have to study things to find out how to counter things. We have to stay ahead of the curve. We have to do proactive prayer and proactive experiments.
I mean, for example, when you talk about, let's pray that a hurricane doesn't hit a specific city, so we move it. Do we move it to another city?
Well, that would be goal-directed prayer, and it shows you the problems with goal-directed prayer. When you remember that movie, Bruce Almighty?
Yeah.
Everything in there was goal-directed for most of the movie for him. He let everybody win the lottery, and what'd that bring? That brought chaos, and he did all kinds of things. What we want to do is have more naturalness to our prayers. What is the divine natural plan for the situation in a hurricane? In other words, we want to pray for safety, and we want to pray for everybody to be in a protective place. But to actually tell a hurricane what to do is actually kind of a goal-directed thing, because everyone's going to be telling them to go in different directions, and it causes more chaos. But if you pray in the way of, we want the establishment of harmony and truth in this situation, then people will at least know how to take care of themselves, and the higher sense of the at the other end of where the answer of prayer is will take care of the hurricane. But we shouldn't interfere with what that answer is. So if we do, we'll have one place that had drought, and now it'll have too much water, or it'll cause trouble someplace else. And this gets into how tricky all this is. And you mentioned the word consequences. I think once humanity finds out from parapsychology and consciousness experiments that their thoughts are affecting things, it's going to spook everybody.
What is stronger, the mass consciousness, millions of people collectively for the good, or one person? Can one person still do what millions can do?
It's very interesting what you're saying there. Yes, if they learn to shut out what groupthink and what other people are thinking and all the noise in their thought, and that is no easy thing. So if they get private thoughts about things, they can. In other words, the trick is to come up with one of the things that the Klingbeils came up with. And this is kind of a wild concept, and I'll try to explain it, something you got to think about for a while. They say if you want to have effective prayer and, beat the masses and beat everybody that's working in a different direction or in a bad direction, or just if you feel that there's a better way to do things and everyone else doesn't, you pray for what's undefended. Now, here's a weird thing. Pray for what's undefended. Find something that nobody else is praying about in a situation and pray for that, because nobody's thought is dwelling on that. Nobody's paying attention to that. And if you do that, the one person can have an effect. But as soon as everybody finds out about what that thing is that you did, then that's over with. You've got to come up with something creative and new the next time. And it only works one session at a time on something like that. Unfortunately, it's not a repeatable thing. So the answer to your question is yes. One can be a majority when that person is open to a solution that's the unexpected, that nobody's expecting, but he's praying for it because it's an area of, and it's not being defended.
Yet not everybody has the prayer strength of, let's say, a Dalai Lama, for example.
Well, that's what we'd like to test people for. We wanted to test different people in the laboratory. We found out some people who thought they were very effective in prayer weren't, and other people who didn't think that they had any talent in prayer were very effective. And some people were goal-directed people, and some people were non-goal-directed people. It's a very interesting thing, testing people from different backgrounds. Let me tell you, I think that our test will ultimately, and this also might be one of the reasons people are enraged with us, will be to test religious leaders. I mean, the Dalai Lama, I mean, the other people who do a lot of praying. Now we have a way to actually test prayers, and then when science comes up with it, are we refining these tests, we'll actually be able to use these to find out who are the good prayers for the earth, who are faking it, and just prayer as a way to make money. Like, you know, we could also test the TV evangelists who are always asking for money.
Oh, sure.
And they say, I'll pray for you. Well, let's test their prayers and see if they're actually doing something. You can see why people would be angry with us, because when you start messing with people's money, you really get people angry. But our prayers can be used for good, too. We could find out who could be on the team of non-goal-directed prayers and who could be on the team of goal-directed prayers. And there's times when goal-directed prayer is an important thing, but we have to make sure that our motives are right. We're asking for the right thing. There's an old joke about a goal-directed prayer that shows that, you know, it's okay, but you could have done better. You know the joke about the guy who prayed to God for a Mustang, and God spoke to him and said, okay, I'll give you a Mustang, but I had a Lamborghini in mind for you.
Exactly.
So sometimes what we pray for, we could do better, but we limit ourselves sometimes.
Well, you know the old saying, be careful what you wish for. And
George,
you could also say, be careful what you pray for.
No doubt about it, because these things happen. And I can give you an example of what you just said. There's a TV commercial running right now. Have you seen it with Diana Krall, the jazz gal who plays piano and sings? You know Diana Krall?
I know her, but I haven't seen the career. I don't watch that much television.
Okay, well, I can understand why. You're busy, busy.
Yes, I am.
There's a commercial now. I think it's an investment commercial. But anyway, Diana Krall is driving her car, and she's thinking to herself, and she's talking out loud, and she says, as a 9-year-old girl, I saw Oscar Peterson play the piano, and she knew that moment that she saw Oscar Peterson, she wanted to grow up and be a jazz musician. Now, that's goal-directed thought, goal-directed prayer working in a good way. See, that would be where she lived her prayer out, and it worked in a good way. But on the other hand, you remember Willie Sutton, one of the most famous bank robbers of all time?
Yeah, sure do.
Okay, well, he was asked when he was a child, what did he want to do when he grew up? And Willie Sutton said, as a kid, he wanted to grow up and be the best bank robber there ever was. So sometimes goal-directed thought gets us into trouble. Both, it works. Goals work. And of course, Jesus says, ask and you shall receive. But we have to be much more careful in our Western culture what we ask for, because a lot of people are asking for the wrong thing. And this is one of the reasons there's a lot of trouble today in countercurrents and psychic things. And you mentioned about these experiments that you've done and you know about. What you want to do in these consciousness experiments, it isn't just a matter of having millions of people having a great mass of thought.
Right, and just throwing it out there.
Right. We have to find out, are people on the same page? Are they of one mind? Are the goal-directed people? What are their motives? One wants it to go this way, one wants it to go that way. That's the safety of non-goal-directed prayer. They will be done prayer. You can't get into trouble with it.
You know, Bill, you bring a different perspective to all of this, to the program. Do you think we need to have someone like you when you do a mass consciousness experiment, or can an individual do it without that professional help?
Well, all they need is guidance, and people can learn to pray. And of course, through Spindrift, they can probably learn, like through my book, A Journey into Prayer, they can learn a lot of these prayer techniques and practice them. It's cultivating the unconscious mind. Everybody gets this. It's just something innate in human beings. This is a funny thing. I don't know if I can say this on the radio or not. Do you remember that Supreme Court justice say that he didn't know how to define pornography, but he knew what it was when he saw it?
I don't remember his name.
Okay, but you remember hearing that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, well, it's the same with this. Quality. Quality is the essence here. When we have really good quality in our thought, quality is the holiness in a person. When we recognize quality, we know what it is. We can't put our finger on it, but it's the amount of quality that we have in our thought that brings about our consciousness to be ready, set, and go for non-goal directed prayer. And that's something that we cultivate. And that's kind of the important thing here, that people, if they can learn to nourish and nurture their consciousness, is to have quality and love and compassion, and especially empathy for what's best in the situation, that will bring them to a state of mind and level of unconscious thought that will surface into their conscious mind and go out cyclically and do good. And you can learn to do that.
The Spindrift Research Organization, you were the president. Is it still exist?
Well, we were 12 people. We're down to 4. We're really kind of encouraging our research to be picked up and work with other researchers right now. We're a loose network compared to what we were. But we do exist, and they can find out about our organization through the website, spindriftresearch.org. We're not doing any formal experiments right now. We're doing a few here and there. A couple of our people are doing some with plants. We have a couple agricultural situations we're praying for, and I'm interested in some experiments that I have not at all figured out how to quantify yet. And I'll just tell you what that is. There's a lot of interest today in sound and music healing, and I'm sort of interested to see what the connection is with music and prayer myself, but I haven't figured out a way to quantify it yet. But everyone kind of intuitively knows, it's kind of all of this thing, everyone kind of intuitively knows that music has a tremendous effect on you. So
the founders, Bruce and John,
yes,
are they dead?
Well, they certainly are. It was that's the big mystery. I don't know if you've heard that part of it. Some people when they investigate Spindrift know about it or not, but I was the last ones to talk to them, and it was a complete mystery what happened there.
When did this happen?
This was in 1993. I just finished a phone call with them. I talked to them about two speeches that they just approved the writing up of, and we're going to be giving it at conferences. And the next thing I knew, I couldn't reach them on the phone. I called people to go find them, and I couldn't find them. And Bruce and John Klimbo were father and son healers, and here they were very involved in the research. And the next thing we knew, they were out in a forest in Oregon, dead, and of apparent suicide. It looked like it was suicide. And
this is strange.
Oh, it's real strange. In fact, everyone involved, the investigators and everything, well, the investigators and the newspaper reporter for the Boston Globe call it a Twin Peaks episode. And it you wonder, why would things like this happen? Well, it made me a little nervous on top of everything else, because I figured, you know, here are these two guys that are on top of this thing. They're some of the geniuses in this area in the world, that they're focused on this area, and they couldn't stop the psychic attack on them, and there was a lot.
That's very interesting you say that, because first and foremost, did they seem like they were enlightened people, happy people? You would never have anticipated a suicide, right?
No, but they could be cynical, and they could have their moments of depression like all of us, and they had their humor sometimes was sardonic, so was mine, but never this. In fact, they didn't believe in suicide. They told me sometimes they didn't believe in suicide. I remember they were very upset during the Vietnam War with these Buddhist priests that poured gasoline on themselves and burned themselves
yes.
up, immolation and all
yes,
that.
Yes, I remember
that. Was
that.
Wrong. And here this happened. So it's and I think you can understand it. I think you probably have a lot of people on all over the place supporting you, and it's working to a positive thing. They're supporting you, and you guys, or and then probably the skeptics don't stay up at late the night to listen to you, but you guys seem to be pretty well protected because you're giving out a lot of information that apparently a lot of people don't want out there on some subjects anyway.
Well, that's true. We had a few of them over the last week or so, and we do try to surround ourselves with positive light.
Yeah.
And that comes off of so many people who listen to this program.
Isn't that wonderful?
Yeah, it is. I feel like I'm in a bubble sometimes, and, you know, it can't get pierced, and it's a good feeling, Bill.
Well, that's the wonderful thing about Coast to Coast. That is, to me, is the chief thing. And what we had at Spindrift, we were just kind of hanging out there on a limb all alone, and we didn't have any real peers to go to, just a few people in the parapsychology field, and they had their own problems. Because anybody who gets into this area, they have strange things happen in their lives. There's hardly anybody in this area has a normal life. There's a few people that have normal lives. And you wonder, why is this? Well, you could even tie it in, I guess, with the alien conspiracy to hold us down the earth so we can't find out about new things. I mean, it's kind of like that. We feel that maybe what happened with the Klingbeils was is that they had this perceived, anyway. It didn't seem to be dangerous to us, but it was perceived that they had some special knowledge about consciousness, mind, and prayer that could break things open. And what that would do would make people find out about things that they never knew were possible. And also, and this is interesting too, who does know about these things? It does seem that certain people do know about the powers of the mind, and they want to keep them to themselves.
How were they found? Were they shot to death?
Yes. And they didn't like guns, so this is a very strange...
They didn't like guns. Was there any letters or anything like that?
Yes, there were.
There were letters.
Yes.
What kind of letters?
Suicide
letters?
Yes, there were.
Well, that makes the thing even stranger, doesn't it?
Yes, and I have mentioned the letters in the book. Chapter 10 of my book is on all the details and the detective story, and we're still trying to figure it out. It's a mystery.
In your opinion, Bill, what do you think happened?
I think it was something like that Korean movie. Remember that movie where the guys were hypnotized to go on and do all these murders? It was a big movie out. The Manchurian Candidate.
Manchurian Candidate.
I think that it was some kind of version like that. In other words, you could take advantage of a person who is very sensitive and psychic and feels a lot of things, and they were empathetic.
So you're saying somebody got to the Klingbeils?
I do. And
both of them?
Yes. And by the way, I've talked to a bunch of people and detectives and your friend Cleve Baxter, and I talked to a bunch of other people. And they've never heard of a father and son committing suicide. It's never been heard of before. I've never heard of it. Have you?
Neither have I. No, that's bizarre.
And Cleve Baxter has been involved in a lot of investigations. Other people can mention other names too. Like he said we should send an investigator out there. The thing is,
what about a murder suicide? One shoots the other, kills him, and then kills himself.
I don't think that was ever came up. Detectives never brought that up. Never brought that up. I think that it's. I don't think so. But I could go back and check, but
checked into it.
Well,
I never know.
Well, I don't think so. But here's what I think it is. Something happened where they were pulled down to a low level and did something that was against their nature. That's for sure. And I know that after it happened, my friends and family here in Chicago, when we found out about it, they wanted me to call the police because they thought, since I was a spokesman at the time for Spindrift, that maybe somebody would come after me. I talked to the police and everything, but it was concluded that by eliminating Bruce and John Klingbeil, they pretty much eliminated Spindrift from having effectiveness from then on. And that seemed to be the case. It was really strange, George. After that happened, the hate mail stopped. People were not upset with us anymore, and it's very, very strange. It was all. I got some quotes in my book from people who were very happy they were gone. They told me they were
very happy they were gone. We'll be back in just a moment. Tell us why.